This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this program. World Jewish Relief have launched their new appeal to support Uyghur refugees in Turkey. Their chief executive, Paul Anticoni, and Rahima Mahmoud, the UK director of the World Uyghur Congress, join me to discuss their plight. As the UK mourns the loss of His Royal Highness Prince Philip, what impact did the Duke of Edinburgh's award scheme have on the Jewish community? Neil Martin, CEO of the JLGB, tells us. And when can we return to Israel, I hear you cry. Well, as the Jewish state announces the easing of restrictions on tourism for next month, how will it work and who can go there? We speak to Sharon Bashadsky, director of the Israel Government Tourist Office in London, to find out. But before all of that, it's time for a look through your copy of the Jewish News for this week. And joining me to go through it is editor Richard Ferrer and news editor Justin Cohen. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Phil.
Hiya, Phil.
Right, let's glance over the front page. And it's a very busy front page this week. Let's start off with the main headline. Reads rather disturbingly, son charged with killing his mother.
So, yeah, we're splashed on the story with active legal proceedings, Phil, so we can't really say anything more than we have written, which are the facts. And the facts are that a 54-year-old man has been charged with killing a 85-year-old woman named Loretta Herman. She was found dead in her home in Ilford last week. A post-mortem has confirmed that her death was caused by a compression to the neck. We've spoken to the police and they confirm that both are Jewish.
Okay, well, I'm perfectly sure that as that story unfolds, as and when, it will be updated at jewishnews.co.uk. Also on the front page, UK Jews offer humanitarian aid to Uyghurs.
Yes, a cause regular listeners will be familiar with. We've long championed it. Indeed, last week, Phil, we discussed on this very show Hugo Boss's suppliers sourcing cotton from Xinjiang province where the Uyghurs are being interned. Well, this week, World Jewish Relief has launched a campaign, an appeal for the 11,000 Uyghur refugees that are living in poverty in Turkey. They've fled to escape Chinese persecution, and they are now living in that country. Many of them are very, very concerned that they are going to be deported back to China. And of course, they then risk internment or worse. Chief Rabbi Ephraim Mervis has again come out very unequivocally in support of this campaign. And it's very gratifying to see World Jewish Relief, one of the biggest Jewish community organizations, taking this on now and pushing it along with many other Jewish organizations. Pressure continues to be brought to bear to ensure that the UK is on the right side of history on this very, very important issue.
Absolutely. I think that it's clear that on this topic, the Jewish community has also been very much on the right side of this. We've seen the community in this country in particular lead any other community in this country and indeed in the world in fighting on the political front for the Uyghur community, in pushing the genocide amendment in Parliament and in fighting for their rights really to be heard. So it's particularly good to see now that the community is also leading on the humanitarian side of things as well. World Jewish Relief have launched this appeal. It's being backed across the community, across communally by every major synagogue organization, by every major charity. And it's fantastic to see. I think that from the case studies that we can read in this week's newspaper, you can see that people are really struggling once they leave China when it comes to a lack of food, a lack of sustenance and accommodation. And so hopefully this campaign will have a tangible difference on the ground whilst the community continues to fight politically as well.
Well, there's no doubt it is sterling work, and I'm quietly confident that with thanks to your work at Jewish News, that there is no doubt that it will be brought to the right attention and hopefully dealt with as swiftly as possible. Let's have a look also on the front page, where there's a rather nice photo of the late Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks and right next to him, the late His Royal Highness Prince Philip.
Yeah, two giants of British society who we've lost in the last 6 months, both of whose service goes beyond what one would imagine. I think what we've noticed in the last few days since Prince Philip's death is that I think many people didn't really realize the extent of his contribution to this country, of his charitable work. They know about his gaffes and they know about allegations of racist comments from time to time, but they don't know about the contribution of the Duke of Edinburgh Awards fully. They don't know about all the other work that he did to make this a better country. And I think also the community wasn't aware of the fact that he had considerable ties to it. We know about Prince Charles's ties, but it's clear that a lot of his contribution would have been inspired by his father's own story, by the fact that his mother, of course, saved Jews during the Holocaust and is recognised as righteous among the nations. And then he himself, before the start of the war in 1933, came to the rescue of a Jewish boy at a school in Germany when he was facing anti-Semitic bullying. So, you know, there's a definite thread running through the family. And I think that we have, a lot to be thankful for about our future king, Prince Charles, and his connections to the community. But it seems to all emanate and perhaps be inspired by his father.
Oh, it certainly seems to. And dare I suggest that despite what most people seem to be sort of saying on social media, I believe he'll be much missed. Let's have a look on page 4. And the headline reads, Far Right Row Over Board Vote.
Yeah, so next month sees the Board of Deputies elect its new president. There is the incumbent, Marie van der Zyl, and the challenger, Jonathan Neumann. Now, I imagine both of them would advocate for many of the community's positions on key policy issues. In fact, the Jewish Manifesto for London was actually published only this week by the board and other organisations, dealing with security, faith schools, anti-Semitism, security, all sorts of things. I'm sure that on those they are very aligned. However, there is a schism, and that schism, I think, is based broadly on Mr. Neumann's book from 2018 entitled To Heal the World, How the Jewish Left Corrupts Judaism and Endangers Israel. It's a pretty controversial title that has got a lot of people's backs up, not least reform deputies in the Board of Deputies who have released a document accusing the caucus surrounding Mr. Neumann as being far right. It's a huge schism at the start of the build-up to this election, with, I imagine, more controversial statements and friction to come in the weeks to come as we head up to the election at the start of next month.
I think the issue here goes far deeper than the two candidates, in reality. It talks to perhaps a wider movement within the community to try and take it to the right beyond where it is currently, which I would say is not exactly very leftist on the whole. So I think these candidates are the representatives of two parts of the right of the community, but one more so than the other, it has to be said.
Yeah, of course, the role of president of the Board of Deputies, this august institution, it should be a unifying role. It should bring the strands of Anglo-Jewry together. And of course, there's still another week for a third candidate, I think, to acquire the amount of support that they will need to enter the fray. It looks, though, like a two-horse race as it stands. And it also looks like this election is going to be fought on things that divide, perhaps, more than unite on a micro level. As I said, on a macro level, I think they're very, very common ground there. But you've got a gentleman here who, and he's not here to speak for himself, and I'm sure we'll debate in the weeks to come, someone who says that Tikkun Olam, you know, healing the world, mitzvahs, social justice, is left-wing politics. And left-wing politics presents, in his mind, I believe, if I'm getting his argument correct, a theological justification to oppose Israel. He sees it as that fundamental. So if that is the case, as I said, there's going to be a lot of spiky words exchanged in the days and weeks to come.
Also, just to say, although, you know, Marie starts off here as the overwhelming favourite, I would say, I don't think many people expect Jonathan to come through here, but he is managing to win significant support. I do understand that he cleared the threshold of 20 supporters that was required to stand very comfortably. And I think, you know, there's a question here about the direction of travel. So yes, this might be an attempt to make inroads, but in the next election, perhaps a candidate from that part of the community could succeed.
Right. Well, there you go. That's all on page 4 of the paper. And naturally, if either candidate or any of the candidates who may crop up in the coming week or so wish to appear on this programme, I've no doubt that they'd be welcome to do so. That's all we've got time for a look at the paper, I'm afraid, for this week. So thank you both very much. Don't forget, if you are isolating and you are unable to get out of the house to collect your copy in person or in print, you'll find the full paper as it would be printed online at jewishnews.co.uk. Editor Richard Ferrer, news editor Justin Cohen, thank you both very much.
Shabbat shalom, Phil.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. One of Britain's biggest Jewish charities has launched an emergency appeal to assist the thousands of Uyghur refugees living in poverty in Turkey, where they fled to escape persecution in China. To talk about this further, I am delighted to say and honoured to say that we're joined by Paul Anticone, who's the chief executive of World Jewish Relief, and Rahima Mahmoud, who is the UK director of the World Uyghur Congress. Thank you both very much indeed for speaking to me. First and foremost, if we start off with you, Paul, this may sound like a silly question, but I think it's one that people want answering. World Jewish Relief, why have you decided to get involved with this particular campaign?
You know, I'm proud that British Jewry over recent months has said enough is enough in the challenge and plight of the Uyghur community, a very large Muslim community in west of China that has suffered incredible oppression and persecution. And British Jewry, led by definitely the Board of Deputies and the Chief Rabbi, have been outspoken in their condemnation of the suffering of this community. And Rahima, leading the World Uyghur Congress, has helped British Jewry look at what we can do to both highlight the plight of this community and mobilize support, and then look at ways that practically we could deliver something. World Jewish Relief is not normally an organization that shouts and doesn't do something, but we are an organization that will not let communities that are in trouble, in need, not receive the support that they require. So we thought long and hard, what way can we use our humanitarian expertise and our operational capacity to provide some meaningful support to the Uyghur community? We don't have access to Xinjiang in China. There's not a community in Britain that requires our support. And Rahima helped us connect to a large Uyghur community in Turkey, some with refugee status, some just with the right to live but not work in Turkey, who were clearly in desperate straits, who needed some very practical support, nutritional support, mental health support. And that's something World Jewish Relief is good at, all over the world, delivering practical services to those in need facing disaster. And today we launch our appeal to mobilise British Jewry to give us the opportunity to really make a difference to about 6,000 Uyghur lives in and around Istanbul. And we're optimistic that we can generate enough support to make a really tangible difference to that community.
And Rahima, can you try and paint a picture for us? Because there will be those listening now who perhaps don't understand the extent of the situation that displaced Uyghur community find themselves living in Turkey. Because obviously it's not bad enough what they've been through in the homeland, but now to actually sort of live in poverty as well. Would you be so kind as to explain the plight of your community in Turkey?
Yeah, thank you so much for organizing this podcast. And also thanks to Paul for that very generous offer and the help when the Uyghurs are, you know, in a such desperate situation in every way at the moment. So the people in Turkey, before I visited and I went to some families myself, I didn't know the extent of the, you know, the struggle that they were facing. So I involved in helping with several documentaries, providing interpreting service. So I just want to give you one example. We interviewed a lady called Kalbinur. She left China because she was pregnant for her sixth child, and she wanted to save the baby because she knew that the Chinese government was visiting all the monitoring any Uyghurs that exceeded any they have this restriction, birth restriction. So in order to save her baby, she came to Turkey and then lost contact with her entire family, including her children who she left behind. So the place where she was living, it was cold, it was dark, and this little young girl who was only two or three years old, when I went to her place, when we interviewed her, throughout for about 2 hours, I was shivering. It was just so cold. And I asked her, she said the accommodation where she's living didn't have the heating facilities. So this is one of the example. And she actually come from a very wealthy background. Husband had a good business, used to do business between Istanbul and Urumqi. So when he returned to East Turkestan for a business trip, and suddenly was arrested. So many, many Uyghurs who initially made to Turkey, they normally had a much better financial background compared to most of the Uyghurs, because in order for you to travel, you need to have money and to support yourself. But because of this sudden crackdown from 2016, criminalizing these normal, ordinary people who just working, normally doing business and supporting their own families, and then suddenly criminalized and arrested and taken away. So Kalbinur left with her youngest daughter and her eldest son, who she traveled when she came to Turkey, and learned that her husband was given more than 10 years prison sentence and lost contact with her own family, including for her other four children. And not only the economic struggle, also psychological. And I met many families, including some young students as well. There are cases of like self-harming cases, because these students came from also very strong financial, good kind of background. Suddenly the parents being arrested and lost contact, no money coming in, and so struggling, trying to, continue with their study, at the same time trying to also find a way to make their end needs. I'm sure the Jewish people understand more than most other communities what it is like when you suddenly lost contact with your loved ones, and not knowing what happened to them when you know there is genocide is happening. So it's an extremely difficult situation at the moment. So with World Jewish Relief providing this kind of, not only just food and medical, but especially the psychological support, which is really desperately needed, because psychological depression can lead to many other problems and health problems as well. And I know the Jewish people has experience, and I'm just extremely, extremely happy.
Well, Paul, just listening to Rahima speaking there, she rightly identifies, I think it's something that Jewish community can sadly absolutely relate to. And in fact, I was just thinking how familiar just that one example sounded for so many examples of, say, the Holocaust.
Exactly. I mean, I think this issue resonates with our community very powerfully. We've seen over many years Britain's Jewish community be outspoken and generous in support, particularly of communities fleeing persecution and seeing sanctuary in other countries. We saw it since 2015 with the refugee crisis domestically. And World Jewish Relief has, you know, great heritage dating back to our role in the 1930s, providing emergency support, mental health assistance, and livelihoods and jobs for Britain's Jewish community then, and for the Uyghur refugee community today. We like to say that we helped refugees in the 1930s because they were Jewish, and we help refugees today because we are Jewish. And I'm very proud that World Jewish Relief, I'm fronted by the Jewish News, backed by an entirety of Britain's Jewish communal agencies. I mean, this really is an issue that brings our community, that many think is fragmented, but it really brings us all together with human rights agencies like René Cassin and J-Corps really fronting it. I think this issue resonates with many, and I'm glad that we're able to put that passion and that power and that sense of morality and responsibility into some means of practical action.
Rahima, just to give us an idea of what it's been like for you personally, because you've obviously very kindly and candidly told us what the situation's like in Turkey, but have you still friends and families in East Turkestan, Xinjiang province? Do you still have any contact with people you know there, or is that not happening at the moment?
No, sadly, my last contact with my eldest brother was January 2000. I have 9 siblings. Luckily, I will say, luckily, my parents died, didn't have to see this absolute horrible situation. So I don't know what happened to my brothers, my friends, and all I know, they're very well-known people who have been made to disappear or sentenced or forced confession, recent video released by the CCP. We only know those information. Otherwise, it's very difficult to get any information, a truthful information about what is happening inside.
Well, I can't thank you both enough for speaking out about this and for speaking to us on the Jewish News podcast. For more information, please do go to worldjewishrelief.org/Uyghur. And for those who don't know, Uyghur is spelt U-Y-G-H-U-R. Paul Antoconi, Chief Executive of World Jewish Relief, Rahima Mahmoud, UK Director of the World Uyghur Congress. Thank you both very much indeed.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, the country this week is coming to grips with the loss of His Royal Highness Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh. But some people may not know that he had quite the link to our very own community. And to discuss this further, and in particular the impact of the Duke of Edinburgh Awards scheme had on the community, we can now speak to a friend of the show, Neil Martin, OBE, who's the CEO of JLGB, joins me now. Neil, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us again. Frankly, I'm thinking of making you a co-host on this show, if I'm honest with you. But in all seriousness, we are here for a solemn reason, and it's obviously very sad news about the Duke of Edinburgh this week. Not entirely unexpected, but sad all the same. But the link between the Duke of Edinburgh and the JLGB goes quite a way back, doesn't it?
Yes, when the Duke of Edinburgh first had his ideas for the award, way back when, several national youth organisations were asked to help be part of a pilot scheme to get it off the ground. And JLGB was one of those, the only Jewish youth organisation involved. And we've been doing the award for the entire community ever since, 65 years later.
Tell us a little bit about how the award works within JLGB, because there may be some people who actually don't know, even after all these years, how the Duke of Edinburgh Award Scheme actually works.
Sure. So there's two aspects to it. One is the award itself, and one is the uniqueness of JLGB. The award itself is the leading achievement award for young people in the world, and it's in 4 sections for bronze, silver, and there's a 5th section for gold. So there's a skills section, a physical section, a volunteering section, and the expedition, and a residential in the gold award. And you have to spend 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months working on a particular self-development. And the uniqueness about the award itself, unlike many other programs, is that each individual young person
chooses what they want to do. I'd like to enhance my skills in whatever it may well be. I'd like to learn the piano. I'd like to do first aid, etc. And so it's a real challenge. And the reason that it's held in such high esteem by universities and employers is you can't just tick a box to do the Duke of Edinburgh Award. You've got to work really, really hard. And the uniqueness about JLGB and the award is very much similar to what we do with other awards as well and other programs, is that we make sure that everyday youth activity is accessible to Jewish young people. And the award, the Duke of Edinburgh's Award, was the first place in which we did that, to say that there are certain parts of the award that if you keep kosher, or if you in your Shomer Shabbat, etc., that certain ways the award is run by other people meant that you couldn't participate and there were barriers to taking part. And so over 65 years, and even more so in the last 10 years with the Pairs Foundation, we now have over 50% of Jewish young people in the UK taking part in the award in all the Jewish schools, in community centres, in special needs charities as well, and in JLGB groups and other groups around the country. Nearly 1,000 kids a year do the award, in a way that you know that it's trusted, that everything you're doing meets the requirements of the award, but also Jewish standards and practices.
I was reading that apparently the award itself was inspired by a friend of the Duke of Edinburgh who himself happened to be Jewish.
When Prince Philip was at Gorston, the head teacher and the founder of the school, Dr. Kurt Hahn, was himself Jewish, a German refugee who fled the Nazis, and very involved in the leading light in education and experiential education. And there was an award at the school that was inspired and helped to, Kurt Hahn's main thing was about the mind, body and spirit, and developing a young person in all those different aspects. And so Prince Philip, when he wanted to create an award, used those very tenets, which became, eventually it changed names over the years, but it became the volunteering section, the physical section, the skills section, and the expedition section. So you develop the different parts of human self-development, and it's kind of a self-help tool.
Now, I understand that you yourself had the chance to meet Prince Philip, possibly on more than one occasion, I don't know, being involved in JLGB in the way that you are. But tell us about the time that you did meet him.
So it's a bit weird in the sense of we knew this day would come, and I've been honoured to do a variety of different television programmes, including on the BBC Breakfast this week as well. So we're proud to play tribute. But I want to say that in the as custodian, as CEO of JLGB, 125 years old, it's not me, it's the organisation, and it's the fact that I have this position that has put me in some very unique circumstances because of the role that I have. And I had the privilege and honour of meeting many members of the royal family, particularly Prince Philip, with the award several times over the last 15, 16 years or so. And two particular occasions spring to mind. One, before I started at JLGB, but I was a very active JLGB volunteer with the bands, and the bands were asked to play at Barnet Copdal for the Queen's Golden Jubilee. And so there was thousands of people there in a stadium, and she was going to come through on a big bus, and then she was going to step off, and then her and Prince Philip were going to talk to some representatives, and they're going to stand on a dais for the kind of final salute and the big finale of the whole of Barnet, paying recognition to the Queen. And they're moving through the line, the band is playing, and all of a sudden, Prince Philip jumps behind the line. And the next thing I know, what we just finished playing a song, he's talking to the kids. And he goes up to the kids and say, OK, which one of you is miming? Go, you're not playing really, are you? He's having real fun with them. He's talking to me, etc., and having a whole conversation. Then he said to me, so then what are you going to play next? And I looked at him and said, well, it's meant to be God Save the Queen, the national anthem, sir. And he had a look on his face and said, well, I better get back in my place then. So he really had a great spirit in that sense. And then several years later, when I was CEO of JLGB, we were invited to the 50th anniversary of the Duke of Edinburgh's Award at Buckingham Palace. You can read this in my op-ed in the Jewish News this week if you want the more detail. But the truncated version is that I found myself, amongst many other CEOs of charities, in the Royal Tea Tent, where 8,000 people were in the gardens. I was in this massive tent with about 20 people. And the next thing I know, I'm talking to Sir Roger Bannister and Buzz Aldrin, two of the main big celebrities and more than celebrities in terms of their achievements, asking me why I was there. And of course, I was quite humble about it, talking to these two. And I explained what JLGB does and our relationship with the award, where I felt this presence behind me. And as I turned round, listening intently was Prince Philip standing over me. And as I turned around to kind of make it part of the conversation, he went, come on then, tell me more. And so I started to explain about the issues of young Jewish people taking part in the award, etc. So we provide kosher expeditions in all the Jewish schools. And as I was explaining it, the Queen walked in to this tent and literally he grabbed her by the arm and he said, come on, and this is what I'm sure in my brain I heard him say, come and listen to this, Liz. They do kosher expeditions. And then I find myself telling the Queen and Prince Philip all about what we do for the Haredi community, single gender provision, the work we do with special needs schools as well to provide adapted single gender expeditions for ultra-Orthodox kids with special needs, etc. And they were it was like the most amazing thing they'd ever heard. And they were really excited about it. And it's a moment I'll never forget. But in that moment, I was proud to explain to the royal family what we've done for him, but also how the award has helped. We've calculated this last week. We think over 25,000 Jewish young people have done the award with JLGB in the last 65 years.
Wow. Well, I think it is fair to say on that very point that the community has an awful lot to be thankful for towards the Duke of Edinburgh, and I'm not entirely sure that they know that. So perhaps you could highlight just how so that is the case.
Well, there are others more expert than me on his wider life and community. Of course, his mother was a righteous amongst the nations and helped to save Jews in the Holocaust, etc. But he is, as a supporter of interfaith work and the whole royal family, and of course, we're privileged now to have the Prince of Wales, his son, as our patron as well. They've always just been very supportive to make sure that British Jewish life thrives and that they recognise the contributions we've made. It's one of the reasons people often ask, why is there a separate Ajax parade? And the Ajax parade was, of course, given because of the contribution that British Jews gave in World War One then as well. So throughout the generations of the royal family, they've been very supportive. But the Duke of Edinburgh is particularly at the top of that list for us in terms of what he's done with the Duke of Edinburgh's award, and also in terms of all the other national youth organisations and him and Prince Charles, a particular keenness through the Duke of Edinburgh's award and the Prince's Trust and other awards as well to ensure that young people have the best possible chance to succeed. And they really do think that every child matters, including Jewish young people. And that's our mission to work together to make it happen. And we think that I have no doubt that there'll be a resurgence and renaissance of the award. And individual young people will do the award, and 1,000 more Jewish young people will do the award in his name over the years to come.
And just finally, Neil Martin, OBE, CEO of JLGB, how will you remember His Royal Highness Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh?
In many ways, and I'm sure JLGB and other organisations will do things post-lockdown in a more formal way. But if you look at some of the photos we've got in JLGB, in the more traditional JLGB, if you've got your award, you get to wear a maroon hat instead of a blue hat. There are hundreds and hundreds of kids have got the award. In fact, the other day, my father found his record book from 1960. He did the award. So the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, maybe. So there's just something about what he created that will be remembered forever, because it doesn't end now. It's going to carry on, and generations upon generations will improve their self-development because of the award he created. And that's the best way to remember him.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, vaccinated Brits will be able to travel to Israel after the 23rd of May, its health ministry has announced. Tourists will need to undergo two different coronavirus tests, a basic one before boarding a flight and after landing, and a second upon leaving Ben Gurion Airport to confirm a vaccination or recovery from COVID. To discuss this further, I'm delighted to say that we are joined by Sharon Bershadsky, who's director of the Israel Government Tourist Office in London. Sharon, I have to start off by saying, on a personal note, I can't wait to go back to Israel.
I can identify it as I didn't see my family since November 2019 or December 2019. Yeah.
So just to clarify that even sort of Israeli citizens, as it were, or those with Israeli passports, I should say, would also struggle to get back into the country, just in case anyone is forgiven for thinking that it's just because you hold a UK passport means that you can't get back into the country. But Israel have been, needless to say, and not surprisingly, very efficient. So it can't come as a massive shock, obviously, that Israel is going to be amongst the first countries to welcome tourists back. But I would imagine that based on how efficient they've been in dealing with their own fight with COVID, that they're not going to let people in willy-nilly. This is probably going to be very controlled, isn't it?
It is very controlled. As you can see from what the Ministry of Health and Ministry of Tourism declared yesterday, is that this is going to be a two-phase, maybe a bit more, but at the moment, two-phase opening. For the first phase, we will welcome only tourists coming in a group. And so we can control it better because a group usually have a bus or a tour guide. We know where they're staying. It's going to be like a pilot because if you can imagine from now to May and June, how many groups can get organized at the last moment and come. So we know it's not going to be a massive amount of groups, but this is, again, this is a pilot. While hopefully in the second phase, we will allow FITs of individuals to come and enjoy Israel in a more free manner. And yes, like you said before, it's going to include testings more or less like in the UK, but there's an extra level of making sure you have vaccinated with the two doses or you are recovered from COVID. And to make sure this is actually happened, we'll have to do the serological test in Ben Gurion Airport. And to eliminate this test, we will have to come to an agreement country by country to recognize, for example, here in the UK, we recognize the NHS app and all of the documents that are being uploaded. So we don't need to do the serological test anymore. But as you can imagine, this kind of agreement will take a bit of time.
And how do you think it's going to work, or do we know the details of this, when it comes to monitoring the tourists around the country? So we know what's going to happen when someone lands, but is it going to be a case of that those tourists who do get there will be very closely monitored, where they go, who they come into contact with? Has the ministry announced anything along those lines?
So we didn't announce anything in more details. I really hope to receive it in the next 1 or 2 weeks. And again, because phase one will be with groups, it's a lot easier to control. With any kind of group, you have a schedule, you know what hotel the group going to stay, you know the tour guide. So any kind of symptoms one of the tourists will have, the tour guide can be our contact person. We know his details, etc. Because usually a tour guide means he's a licensed tour guide. This is the law. So he will be our contact person. Second stage with the individuals, I can imagine, as I know Israel, it will combine kind of an app that will have to download to your phone. I'm sure Israel, you know, is a leading country in technology, will find a solution.
Now, let's be very clear about this. It's not that Israel doesn't want tourists back, because like so many countries,
oh, God, no.
Israel relies quite heavily on tourism, doesn't it?
We will love to see our tourists coming back. In 2019, we set a record of about 5 million tourists. And here from the UK, we had more than 200,000. It was a lot. And 2020 actually started with another record in January and February. We love our tourists. We invest a lot of money in getting them to Israel and to introduce them. You know, it's a lot for Israel. I think maybe your listeners knows it. It's a lot more than just tourism. It's just the door to Hasbara, to showing the beautiful face of Israel, showing that Israel is not only politics. So it's a lot more behind the touristic, you know, experience, but we love our tourists and we can't wait to get them back. We just need to do it in a more careful manner. You know, health and safety is something extremely important to the Israeli people. And finally, it's maybe a lot of people around the world didn't know about it, but finally they do, and they can see it, that we care a lot about the health and safety of our citizens. This is number one. And number two, now opening the country, also health and safety of our tourists.
Now, there are some people who have said that they are not hopeful of any semblance of normality, even though we obviously know that 23rd of May is the date when tourists will be allowed to drip back in again, so to speak, and obviously with those very strict measures that we've mentioned. But do we think, hopefully, like any chance by, say, Rosh Hashanah, so that 5782 is going to be the new year later this year, or are we looking more towards the beginning of, say, 2022? Or do we just not know? Yes, it really is going to be based on how things progress.
Honestly, we don't know, because it would have to monitor the situation slowly and see how it goes. Every few weeks, we learn about a new variant. You know, we just don't know what we don't know. Having said that, the first stage going to be only for groups. I can imagine it would be no longer than around July that they will think about it, monitor it, and having the possibility of opening up to individuals. So if you take it in a 2 month base, July, so yeah, until September, which is the Jewish holiday season, it's if everything will be okay, it sounds to me very logical to assume we can celebrate Rosh Hashanah, everyone in Israel, everyone again vaccinated. I do not know what to say about people that will not get vaccinated. This is, you know, more of a Ministry of Health jurisdiction, but let's wait and see.
Just finally, if anyone wants any more information or maybe to keep up to date with how the ministry is thinking and the movements that it's making to try and welcome tourists back, I assume the tourist office website is the best place for them to go?
Yeah, we always publish everything that we do, obviously, around the media. I'm sure they will be able to read about it in the Jewish news, but also in our website and Visit Israel, on Facebook, also Instagram. So we're pretty much around everywhere. We do a lot of virtual activities, events, hostings, you know, chefs and everything that everyone has been doing for the past year. We're there online and it's easy to see us. So join in and just learn all about the latest news.
Sharon Bashadsky, Director of the Israel Government Tourist Office in London. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on the Jewish News Podcast.
Thank you for hosting me. It's been a pleasure.
And that's it for this edition of the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. To find out more, visit gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is to say thank you to our guests, Paul Antoconi, Rahima Mahmoud, Neil Martin, Sharon Bashadsky. Thank you also to our paper review team, Richard Ferrer and Justin Cohen. And we must also say thank you to Justin Cohen for producing this episode. And we must also say thank you to you for listening. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll hear any previous episodes or be informed when new ones become available. And don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. If you'd like to comment, well, we'd love to hear from you. All you have to do is email editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Phil Dave, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.